This is the takeaway for Wednesday, August 30th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. And we begin with the devastation of Hurricane Harvey for millions of Americans all along the Gulf Coast.
We have no electricity, no water, no toilets to flush. So, you know what that means, you know, but we're breathing. I'm thankful for that.
These rains are currently producing catastrophic and life-threatening flooding over large portions of southeastern Texas, and this event is going to continue.
You ever been on a rocking boat? That's the way that two-story house was moving. Just trusting in the wind.
Okay,
Crappy,
where are you at?
Let me be clear. This is not the Superdome. The convention center, we are sustaining food. They have food.
It's pretty intense. This is about as real as it gets right now.
After 5 days of relentless rainfall and flooding, Harvey made landfall for a second time early this morning, this time in Louisiana, and this time as a tropical storm. In Texas, hundreds of thousands of people are displaced. Arenas and shelters are far over capacity, and the entire available Texas National Guard has been deployed. Last night, Houston's mayor imposed a curfew to help prevent low-level crime, and to make it easier for rescue workers to reach people who are in need. This is a monumental crisis, with more than 4 feet of rain in less than a week and one of America's biggest cities nearly entirely underwater. Among the dead is veteran Houston Police Sergeant Steve Perez, who died while driving to duty on Sunday when his car was swept away by floods. In a few minutes, we're going to look at some of the immediate and longer-term health threats Houstonians will face in this severe flooding. But first, we go to Louisiana, where 12 years after Katrina, Harvey made landfall in a state that knows storms and severe flooding all too well.
12 years ago, Katrina changed New Orleans forever. We lost 1,800 of our fellow Americans. 1 million people were displaced. 1 million homes were damaged, and another 250,000 homes were absolutely destroyed.
That's New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu. Sue Lincoln is news director for WRKF in Baton Rouge and state politics anchor for the NPR affiliates across Louisiana, and she joins me now. Sue, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd. Happy to be with you. Sorry it's under such dismal circumstances.
And I am too. And these circumstances have been a fact of life in Louisiana for all too long and for too many times, which is why we wanted to bring you on in this moment. First, what's the latest across the state? How are different parts of the state and people who have faced flooding faring now?
Well, it's been difficult. It's been a nerve-wracking week as we've watched Harvey move into the Gulf, build strength, watched what it did to Houston. It has now moved onshore in Louisiana, and the center of circulation has passed over the city of Lake Charles in southwest Louisiana. I lived there for a decade, so I'm very familiar with it. In fact, a block from my former home in Lake Charles, they have received 13 inches of rain thus far. So there is that. People have been tense. People have been reaching out via Facebook and other social media asking for, if you will, empathy from others as we try to cope with the stress of yet another. Here in the Baton Rouge area, we had a devastating flood last August. One recording station in Watson, which is only about 20 miles away from the state capital itself, received over 30 inches of rain. And people here are still trying to rebuild all across South Louisiana because it flooded from the Mississippi border all the way into the Lafayette area. People are still trying to rebuild their homes, and here was this threat that hung over us for a year. So there's been a lot of tension as we watched and waited to see what Harvey would do. Other than southwest Louisiana, it appears that we are not going to feel anywhere near the brunt of the storm. There have been rain bans. Southwest Louisiana, as I said, is flooding. They are 30 feet above sea level in the city of Lake Charles, and its gravity drainage to the Gulf. So it takes a while for that rainwater to move out. The ground was already fairly well saturated before Harvey started dumping rain.
I want to talk about Baton Rouge a little bit more, since the floods from a year ago that you mentioned were so very severe. Update us on the forecast again, if you would, just for the city of Baton Rouge. You mentioned the severe rain. How much more severe are the meteorologists saying it could get there as people try to rebuild from just a year ago?
They were anticipating another 2 to 4 inches of rain over the next couple of days. As of today, it appears that we are fairly in the clear. There are small bands of rain moving through, but they're not producing anything more than about a half an inch of rain as they pass through. And the city is able to handle that. But there is tension, because some people are living in just mudded up walls, meaning that they have replaced their wallboard, but they haven't been able to paint. They haven't been able to replace their flooring. We are still in the process here in Louisiana of distributing the funds that Congress provided for us to have to assist folks with their rebuilding. And that process was ongoing, getting stood up, and has kind of come to a halt temporarily while we wait and see what this will do.
Sue Lincoln, you mentioned these two things, tension and empathy. And it seems to me that those emotions must be flowing both ways from Houston right through Louisiana. I mean, you mentioned these floods just a year ago in Baton Rouge, as people are still rebuilding even today. Hurricane Katrina made landfall 12 years ago yesterday. That's a monumental anniversary. And Louisianans across the state are emotionally and physically still processing the effects of those events while they watch events in Houston and while the rains and the floods come their way yet again.
That's absolutely true. And we've seen a lot of that reaching out as neighbor to neighbor from Texas to Louisiana. Texas, Houston in particular, opened their doors to Katrina refugees in 2005. Texas was very good to send help to us after our floods here in the greater Baton Rouge area last year. There has always been a partnership. The Cajun Navy, which came to a little bit of fame last year in response to our floods, has deployed to Texas to help do rescues. So there is a good sense of partnership and a sense that we're all in this together. But because of that, those who are still trying to process or ignore most of the time the stressors of having been in a major disaster, we're talking sublimated PTSD, are having flashbacks right now.
Talk just for a second about the coffee shop, about your street corner, and what people say to you and what you say to them when you see them.
Mostly it's just, how are you doing? And I'm coping is pretty much the response right now. And we are a very hugging type culture down here. And so you give folks a hug, whether it's state officials, whether it's people you've never met before, and you know that you are sharing a little bit of humanity in an inhumane circumstance.
Sue Lincoln, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
So floodwater of this magnitude comes with huge health risks, and it adds just another layer of complication to an already chaotic and dire situation in Houston. Earlier this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price declared a public health emergency in Texas. So we turn now to Dr. Peter Hotez. He's concerned about far-reaching health risks for individuals confronting this storm. Dr. Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And he says that beyond the immediate risk of drowning, floodwaters bring a wide range of health risks that stay long after the waters recede.
With flooding, there are a number of health hazards, both short-term and long-term. In terms of the short-term ones, of course, drowning, it only takes a few inches of moving water to sweep a person under their feet and affect drowning. We also have the problem that the waters themselves have, there lurk a lot of dangers. You have to worry about snakes here in this part of the Gulf. We also worry about chemical contamination, both household chemicals. And you have to remember the Gulf is the home of many of the world's largest chemical refineries associated with the oil industry. We know there may have been some industrial spillage into the waters, and so that's going to be a concern. So that's a long way of saying that when people are finally rescued from floodwaters, you want to get them cleaned off as quickly as possible. From there, you have a lot of other hazards that we have to look at once you get people to safe ground or shelters, as well as infectious diseases.
What are some of the concerns around sewage and infectious diseases there?
So with the infectious diseases, what we know are first of all, skin infections, cutaneous infections. So staphylococcal bacterial infections. There's a antibiotic-resistant staphylococcus called methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, that we're concerned about. We also have an interesting type of flesh-eating organism down here in the Gulf called a Vibrio vulnificus. And we've had every year there's some serious flesh-eating disease consequences from this Vibrio. So we're going to have to look out for that. But then from there, you have what are called coliforms. These are bacteria from fecal contamination or sewage contamination. So they would include E. coli, Shigella, Salmonella. So we're going to be on the lookout for serious enteric bacterial infections, intestinal bacterial infections. And then once we do get people to shelters, if they're in shelters, there's a lot of stress under those conditions. They're crowded. So we know from Katrina, for instance, there were a number of respiratory infections that followed from Katrina. So far, it's pretty early in terms of worrying about the flu season, although we know from Australia that it looks like it could be a very bad flu season moving into the fall. But also, it was noted that tuberculosis was an important problem after Katrina. So we'll be looking for that.
Dr. Hotez, there is so much water all over the area now, and we're hearing from some of the flooding experts that there could be standing water in the Houston area for weeks, or in some cases even months, and then that water recedes. We all know that standing water means mosquitoes, and that just has to be a major concern for you.
You're absolutely right. Houston is the mosquito capital of the United States. It's one of the reasons why we set up our National School of Tropical Medicine here in Houston. What we do know is that floodwaters in the immediate period can actually wash away mosquito breeding sites. So you could even get a decrease in the number of mosquito-transmitted virus infections like West Nile or dengue or even Zika. But then as you point out, as the floodwaters recede, those leave puddles of water and also puddles of water in standing containers. And so we know historically from Katrina that this was a time when West Nile virus started going on the increase. And with over the course of a year, for instance, there was a doubling of neuroinvasive cases of West Nile virus, the virus causing encephalitis. So I think we're still in the middle of mosquito transmission season. It goes well into the fall here on the Gulf Coast. So we're quite worried about seeing big upticks over time with West Nile virus and possibly Zika and dengue and others. With respect to Zika specifically, we know that in South Texas, we saw Zika transmission in South Texas well into December. So this is something that's going to probably be with us until the new year.
So you're describing all these health concerns, and there are many more, Dr. Hotez. You're also describing the extreme stress, not only of the immediate floodwaters and people's immediate safety, but losing their homes, concern for their families, and the trauma that's going on. Can you talk about the mental health impacts of a disaster like this from a public health perspective?
We have to remember also that even in the best of times, Houston and the surrounding areas have very high levels of extreme poverty. I did all of my medical and graduate training in places like New York and Boston and New Haven, and I thought I knew what poverty looks like. But when we came down here to the Gulf 6 years ago to start the School of Tropical Medicine, we realized that there's a level of poverty and deprivation here on the Gulf that I did not realize even existed in the United States. So you have people who, even under good circumstances, are living under terrible stress. Now you put into that, they're, many of these people have scraped together important, meaningful lives with jobs. Now you take that all away from them. You're taking away their house. Remember, transportation is difficult. They're often dependent on bus routes. So you've taken away their house. In many cases, you've taken away their livelihood as well. And the emotional impact of that has to just be extraordinary, even people with means. But you pile this on of people without means, and it's just absolutely heartbreaking to hear some of the stories that's going on in Houston right now.
Dr. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Hotez, thank you for being with us.
Thanks again for having me.
You're listening there to an air raid siren going off in the Japanese district of Ibaraki early Tuesday. The cause? A North Korean ballistic missile flying over the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. That missile crossed Japan and ultimately landed in the Pacific Ocean. But the launch was considered a direct threat to both Japan and the United States. The government in Pyongyang said in a statement that the missile was fired in direct response to ongoing military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. The United Nations Security Council, meanwhile, unanimously condemned that test, but appears unlikely to take any responsive action, at least at the moment. Joshua Pollack is Senior Research Associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Joshua, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Joshua Pollack, we've been reporting over and over again on the latest North Korean missile test. I don't want to say they're becoming routine, but they are becoming frequent. How big a deal is this test that flew over the territory of Japan?
Well, it's not the first time North Koreans have sent a rocket over Japan. They've actually tried it 7 times, and this is the 5th time it's gone over. The 3rd time over the main islands, twice over small islands to the south that are very lightly populated. But I think it is a shock to the Japanese nevertheless. For one thing, the 4 earlier rockets to go over Japan were space launchers. They carried satellites. They were not designed to carry nuclear weapons necessarily. And the North Koreans moved them away from a site where they had to fly over the main islands. So in recent years, they've been going over these small southern islands very far from the mainland. So this is a move back to the mainland. Furthermore, the missile test campaigns of the last couple of years have involved a practice designed to keep the missiles from going over Japan. This is called lofting, where the North Koreans shoot them unusually high so they do not carry out over Japan into the Pacific. They've now set that practice aside, and I think the concern in Japan is that they are going to continue to do this, and there is no particular way to stop them.
So what's the overall message that should be interpreted from the North Koreans then? They did have the ability to launch these missiles high, and they dip in the ocean. Now they're making them go over Japan. What are they saying?
They're saying that they are going to ignore Japanese concerns and simply test missiles to their heart's content where and when it suits them.
So was there any new technology involved in this launch, or is the difference here sort of the messaging and the provocation of launching it over Japan?
I think what is new is going over Japan. Now, they did pick a route that minimized the populated areas it flew over. This is less aggressive than what they threatened in mid-August, which was 4 missiles to be shot into the vicinity of Guam. That would have had to pass over some heavily populated areas in southern Japan. But instead, they chose a single missile over a thinly populated area to the north.
And I don't want to suggest that this is a detente, but if it is less provocative than they threatened and less provocative than they were capable of doing, what message does that send?
That suggests that they prefer to proceed in a step-by-step manner, probably so the rest of the world gets used to what they are doing and does not react too strongly to any single step. If they had done too much, I think it might have united the Chinese with the Americans and their allies and really put them at risk of a severe response. Instead, they're being more cautious. This choice of action may have been connected to American actions or inactions, if you like, since the threat to test around Guam was linked to the flights of bombers out of Guam to the vicinity of North Korea. And they made it clear that their threat was designed to respond to that type of action. Since the United States apparently has not conducted any bomber flights like that since they made their threats in mid-August, they may have decided that they didn't have sufficient justification to do a test like that.
So Joshua Pollack, the president from the White House, has said something. He said, "The world has received North Korea's latest message loud and clear. The regime has signaled its contempt for all of its neighbors." The president continues, "All options are on the table." Is this standard fare from the president or something different?
That's a pretty far cry from fire and fury, I will say. This statement appears to have been written by staff. I don't think it comes from the president. It didn't come out of his Twitter feed. It didn't come out of his mouth before the TV cameras. And there's a lot to be said for that. This is a return to more standard messaging. All options are on the table means precisely nothing. And it maximizes flexibility. That's what that statement is meant to do. And that's why there's a tendency for American governments to revert to that language or versions of it. The part about contempt, I would say, is certainly correct when it comes to Japan. This expresses contempt for Japan, indifference to Japanese concerns, and it expresses a blunt rejection of past Security Council actions against North Korean space and missile launches. I think that is par for the course, too.
Joshua Pollack, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Joshua Pollack is a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He's also the editor of the Nonproliferation Review. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Flooding from Hurricane Harvey has the attention of Americans this week, and at least 18 people, as many as 30 or more, have already died in Texas. But it's monsoon season in India and Bangladesh and Nepal, and some reports say over 1,200 people have died already this summer in floods and landslides. The United Nations estimates that at least 41 million people in South Asia have been affected by the consequences of heavy rains. Annie Gowan is India Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Annie, welcome.
Thank you.
Describe just how heavy some of the monsoon rains across South Asia have been this summer.
Today and yesterday in Mumbai, which is India's commercial capital, the entire city has been shut down by extremely heavy rains. There's flooding about up to 5 feet at some places. You know, all the roads, all the, you know, the C-Link highway and the railways are all shut down. So essentially the city is paralyzed by the heavy rains that are going on there now. But of course, 1,200 people have been killed in heavy rainfall across eastern India and down into Bangladesh and up in Nepal during this monsoon season, which began in July.
Now, you described conditions in the commercial capital of Mumbai. What does that level of rain look like when it reaches the countryside and farms and villages?
What the Red Cross and other emergency agencies are saying is that the flooding is devastating, and it's some of the worst flooding that they have seen in over a decade. And right now, as we speak, you know, there's still thousands of villages in the eastern part of India that are still cut off without food, water, supplies, emergency services, etc.
Annie, monsoons come every year. You mentioned that people who watch the rain say this is the worst in a decade. Are these rains and this flooding off the charts in terms of what people are used to in the yearly cycle or even the decade cycle in the area?
Yeah, so of course, India, Bangladesh, South Asia, they're monsoon areas. So, you know, the bulk of their rainfall comes during the monsoon period every year from June to September. And of course, in Mumbai itself, always floods, and we've all seen the pictures of people, you know, wandering around the city in flooding water. Happens every year, but in this case, you know, most people who are observing this are saying that this is the worst that it's been in some time. Of course, the climate change is to blame for that. India, Bangladesh are two of the most vulnerable countries where we're already seeing the effects of climate change. You see that in rising temperatures in the Bay of Bengal, which result in faster rising sea levels and stronger storm surges and more powerful cyclones.
Do regular people there, Annie Gowan, make the connection to these floods and climate change, even in a place where floods happen all the time?
I think when you go and talk to them, they do say in the villages that people talk about water drying up and they talk about the crop changes that they experience. So they do. I think that many of them are aware that, I mean, at least that things are different than they used to be, say, 20 to 40 years ago.
Where do people go in such huge flooding? What does displacement look like, especially in the countryside when large swaths, when villages and farms get flooded?
Well, I think, you know, it's similar to, I guess, what's happening to Houston. People move to higher land. They go stay with families in cities. I think that one of the big concerns, like in the long run, is that many of these people who are going to be displaced by climate change will be permanently displaced, and they'll be going into cities that are already overcrowded, like Mumbai, Kolkata, Dhaka. So you have a long-term impact on these mega cities that are already overburdened with population increases.
Severe flooding across India, Bangladesh, and Nepal has claimed at least 1,200 lives. Annie Gowan, India Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
While Houston is still fighting the ongoing destruction of Hurricane Harvey, nearby in San Antonio, Texas, a federal judge faces a looming deadline to decide whether or not to block a controversial immigration law. A judge has to decide by midnight Thursday on an injunction against Senate Bill 4, or SB 4. That law limits so-called sanctuary cities' ability to protect undocumented immigrants in Texas. Cities like San Antonio and Austin and immigrant groups are challenging the constitutionality of SB 4 in court. Julian Aguilar is border and immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune. Julian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us what exactly SB 4 does in Texas.
Well, it does quite a few things. The three main things that people are focused on while they're waiting for a federal judge to decide on whether it should be allowed to take effect is jail administrators, you know, constables, sheriff's deputies, whoever's in charge of letting people in and out of a county jail or a city jail must comply with ICE detainers. That's from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and those are requests to hold somebody while ICE is en route to pick them up because they possibly qualify for deportation under federal immigration laws. The second thing it does is it prohibits local governments, police chiefs, constables, anybody that has jurisdiction or supervisory power over law enforcement officers. It prohibits those people from telling their officers that they cannot ask about immigration status when a person is under arrest or under lawful detention. And I think that's the sticking point to this main provision. That second provision is the detention. And the third thing is that anybody found in violation of these provisions would be subject to a Class A misdemeanor and potential removal from office.
Why do the cities and the groups and the other plaintiffs here think that these provisions you describe are unconstitutional?
They think it violates, their ability to speak with freedom about the policies. You know, it's a free speech issue, they say. They say police officers or department heads should be able to craft policy based on what they think is the best. Case in point, you know, there's a severe flooding. Are you going to tell your officers not to check immigration status? Well, that seems like the likely choice if that's not your priority, but if the Senate bill goes into effect, that they won't be able to limit what can be asked and what can not be asked.
Now, you mentioned how SB 4 would operate during severe flooding, like the flooding going on in Houston right now, even though this law was signed back in May. Houston's Mayor Sylvester Turner spoke almost directly to this at a press conference last week. Listen.
I don't care who you are. I don't care what your status is. I do not want you to run the risk of losing your life or a family member because you're concerned about SB 4 or anything else.
That's the mayor of Houston there. Is there any evidence that fears over SB 4 are causing people to stay away from authorities during the flooding?
Yes, there is. I'm in Austin, so I haven't spoken to anybody directly, but just looking at social media accounts, speaking to state representatives that are in that area, and even though it does not go into effect until Friday, there's a lot of rumors going around about what police officers are already doing, which is one, deterrent, and also because these rescue efforts are going to continue well past Friday, you know, for weeks, if not months. So people are already asking, hey, you know, if I need help come Friday and I don't have legal status, what am I going to do?
So Texas awaits a decision from a federal judge by Thursday. What does the state say? The governor signed this bill. What does Greg Abbott say?
Well, the supporters say it's needed. They claim that several sheriffs in Texas are not honoring these detainers. And by not doing that, they are letting criminal aliens, is the term that they use, out of their jails. So that's the main reason that Governor Abbott and the bill backer said this was needed. But the lawful detention part, I think, is what's really, really causing the most heartache. You know, you have Democratic senators, state senators that are saying, you know, it starts with a broken taillight, leads to a broken family. But this is something that also has been argued before in the Arizona case I mentioned earlier. So the issue of preemption, a lot of folks, including the Justice Department, who supported SB 4 during the court hearing in late June in San Antonio, lawyers for the Trump administration said this was decided by the Supreme Court with the Arizona case. So they're saying it's not an issue anymore and this law should be able to stand. But what attorneys for the ACLU and the other municipalities that are suing the state argue is that the Arizona statute specified that an officer had to have reasonable suspicion before he or she asked about a person's status. The Texas bill doesn't include that provision in it.
Julian Aguilar with the Texas Tribune. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back now on The Takeaway, I'm Todd Zwillick, and we have more on the ongoing fight over sanctuary cities. Los Angeles is the latest city to challenge the Trump administration over its threat to deny federal grant money to sanctuary cities. Last week, L.A. announced it was joining San Francisco and the state of California in a lawsuit against the Justice Department. That suit is trying to block new rules imposed by DOJ that require local law enforcement to fully cooperate with federal immigration officials in order to get public safety grant money. For Los Angeles, those grants are worth about $1.8 million. But that cooperation includes giving immigration authorities access to local jails and also forces local police to notify federal authorities 48 hours before releasing anyone suspected of immigration violations. The city attorney in Los Angeles is Mike Feuer. He's the man filing the suit on behalf of his city. And he says the federal grant money LA stands to lose would make it harder for Los Angeles to police its streets.
For us, it's about $1.8 million, which we share with the county of Los Angeles. The irony here, of course, is that the Justice Department, which is intent on being tough on crime, would hold hostage money to help us prevent crime. In particular, this grant is very important to us here. It's a grant that funds a program that combats gang activity and gang violence. It's called our Community Law Enforcement and Recovery Grant. It was, when it was first put in place a couple decades ago, a real model, and it remains so. But it was innovative at the time because of the cross-jurisdictional collaboration this requires between the city and the county, between communities on the one hand and local authorities on the other. And it's been very effective in reducing violent gang-related offenses in the areas of our city where it's been in place. And so here the Attorney General comes along and threatens this funding, and in so doing, potentially jeopardizes public safety, which is antithetical to his purported goals.
So you're talking about the Byrne JAG grant here, Mike Feuer. You said it's about $1.8 million. What types of places around LA has this money been effective? What would really happen if it went away?
Well, if it funds local prosecutors, including prosecutors in my office, it funds probation staff, it funds the district attorney's office, it funds an anti-gang program here in the city of Los Angeles. The money's been focused on neighborhoods of Los Angeles where gang activity is most prevalent. The result of this grant has been about a 20% diminution in violent crime compared to neighborhoods where the grant is not in place. So it's clearly been effective. LA has received this grant for 20 years, year in, year out. A key point is this is a formula-based grant. It's based on population and crime statistics. This would be the first time that one of the criteria for whether a jurisdiction receives the money is whether it allows the federal government to impose on us an immigration-related condition. And what's really key about that, Todd, is we're talking about civil immigration enforcement. That's what these conditions are all about. But the grant is not about anything to do with civil law nor immigration enforcement. The grant is about public safety. creating opportunities for local jurisdictions to be creative about making our neighborhoods safer. That has nothing to do with civil immigration enforcement.
So you're going to make this legal case with your co-plaintiffs that the Justice Department can't impose these civil immigration provisions on a federal grant. But talk about the local situation in your town. Talk about L.A. and what it means politically or even to the community to have a threat of this money going away, given the large number of recent and not so recent immigrants that Los Angeles County has.
Well, here in Los Angeles, we have been focused for four decades on trying to engender trust between immigrant communities on the one hand and law enforcement on the other. Policies to do that took effect under a very conservative police chief about 40 years ago, because across the political spectrum, there is wide recognition that everyone in our city is safer when immigrants are prepared to come forward regarding whether they've been a victim or a witness of crime, irrespective of immigration status. So when the federal government seeks, in effect, to use this grant to make LAPD an arm of federal civil immigration policy, what it does is it threatens to erode the trust that we have been successful in building year in, year out, for decades with our immigrant communities.
Well, what you just said, Mike Feuer, might go to the response that's been put out by the Justice Department. Spokesperson Devin O'Malley said about the lawsuit coming from Los Angeles and California that reversing sanctuary city policies is about more than just enforcing federal immigration law by detaining criminals here illegally. It's about reestablishing a culture of law and order where crimes are punished and people are deterred from committing them. Your response?
That response has nothing to do with what happens on the ground here in Los Angeles. The jail policies that are at issue with these proposed conditions from the federal government regard local Los Angeles jails where we don't hold people who have been convicted of crime. We hold people who've been stopped, who've been arrested for a very short time, typically for 48 hours or less. Again, this points out something about the federal government's immigration enforcement strategies that's very troubling. Back a few months ago, when the executive order the president issued came out, it had a number of provisions in it that have been largely overlooked in public debate. The provisions that I'm concerned about here are those that express the priorities for deportation by the federal government. The priorities include trying to focus on those who've committed acts that could be charged as crimes, those who have been charged with crimes, but whose cases haven't been adjudicated yet, and so on. This is really a stunning effort by the federal government not to focus on those who've actually committed offenses. Not at all. This is about something quite different from that. And so are these conditions, certainly as applied to a city like Los Angeles. All of us want to make our communities safer. Local leaders in Los Angeles, both law enforcement and their civilian overseers here, have made clear for four decades that our city is safer when those who have been victimized by crime or witnesses come forward, irrespective of being concerned about their immigration status. And we have seen a meaningful diminution in crime here in Los Angeles. Our crime rates are substantially lower than they were when we first received this grant back in 1997. So in the main, these policies have been constructive and have been working. The federal government, the Trump administration, doesn't apparently have any idea about the efficacy of these policies and seeks to layer these conditions that would undermine the trust that has contributed to increased public safety in our city.
Well, we'll see how these lawsuits turn out as jurisdictions and states across the country challenge the Trump Justice Department putting conditions on local law enforcement grants for its immigration priorities. Mike Feuer, the Los Angeles City Attorney, thanks so much.
Sure. Todd, thanks very much.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Millions of kids across the country are starting school this week. And yesterday, we heard about how access to early childhood education is spotty in America, even as programs expand nationwide. And we've been hearing a lot from all of you about some of the changes you'd like to see for pre-K in the United States.
Hey, this is Ted Holly. I'm calling from Vancouver, Washington. I actually moved here with my family to escape the horrible education system of Florida. And basically, my take on this is that education is literally the most egregiously underfunded facet of modern life. Our kids should definitely begin school as early as 3 years old. Starting sooner is going to help them develop the social skills that they need to adjust to society and hit the ground running.
This is Stacy from Key West, Florida. I think kids should start school around 3. It should be public at that age, but I don't think it should be mandatory because every kid needs preparation for kindergarten, but they all need different levels of preparation. And it shouldn't be available only for people who have a lot of money or none at all. It should be available for everybody.
But even as more kids are attending school earlier, what they're learning and how they're learning it varies from classroom to classroom, and it often doesn't match up with the best science. That's the lesson that Suzanne Bouffard learned when she began to look at pre-kindergartens with her own toddler. At the time, Bouffard was a child development specialist at Harvard, and the experience set her on a course across the country visiting classrooms for her new book. It's called The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. Bouffard says the importance of early childhood education is recognized now more than ever, and that right now might be our best chance to get it right.
It's the most important year for a number of reasons. For many children, this is their first experience of school. It's their first opportunity to get excited about learning and about the idea of school, and that feeling can stay with them for the rest of their education. And we're at a really interesting and important time in the history of early childhood education, because we have more funding for public pre-K and other early childhood programs than ever before. But I have been worried over the last few years, as I've seen programs scale up very quickly, that we're not paying enough attention to how we're doing that. And that if we don't pay attention to that now at the beginning of creating our pre-K programs, we may look back regretfully in a few years, or even worse, policymakers may look back and say, we tried pre-K, it didn't work, let's move on to something else.
Because they didn't do it right in the first place. Well, I definitely want to talk about the science of what works and whether it's reaching little classrooms. But before we do that, what do we know about small children and their brains and their abilities that informs how early they should start school and what that should be like?
We've known for a long time that early childhood is a critical period for developing all kinds of skills. But over the last decade, we've developed a really large base of research that shows just how much brain development happens during early childhood. And that's because the brain makes more connections more quickly during early childhood than at any other time. And if you nurture those pathways and you foster them, the brain makes more and more connections. But the pathways that you don't use get pruned off, as neuroscientists say, in a kind of use it or lose it mentality. While we don't have a specific age that we know is important for kids to start learning in a classroom, we do want all young children to have enriching learning experiences from birth. There are a lot of ways that children can get that, whether it's at home or in an early childcare program or in a playgroup. But as children get older, to ages 3 and 4, there are some real benefits to beginning to experience a classroom environment, because it helps young children learn to be part of a class, to follow the expectations for a classroom, and interact with their peers in a way that they don't when their families are around. For example, there are some studies that suggest that children who are in kindergarten classrooms with larger percentages of classmates who went to preschool do better. It's really interesting because in that case, it's not even whether the child herself went to preschool, but whether her classmates did. It's especially true for children from low-income families and for children with low language skills when they come in.
So let's talk about best practices before we talk about anything else. What are the best programs doing that's right out of the research that they should be doing?
They engage children in learning in ways that are exciting and interesting and that are developmentally appropriate. They do things like introduce children to the world around them, to how things work. They ask them questions about, what are you thinking? Why did you design the block ramp that way? And what happened when you experimented with cars to see how fast they would go? They really get children thinking. And one of the ways they do that is to set up activities that are hands-on and that are fun and that to children are play, but they have a learning goal in mind.
So those are some of the best practices in programs around the country. What about the worst?
One of the things that concerns me the most are classrooms that are really focused on drilling basic skills. And In my reporting, I saw that these kinds of programs are more common in neighborhoods that tend to serve low-income children. The reason for that, the justification given is often that children from less resourced families tend to start school behind. So when I visited classrooms that have what is sometimes called a skill and drill approach, they did a lot of lecturing at children, a lot of flashcards, a lot of chanting songs, very little of the hands-on exploratory play that I described before. And young children's brains are just not wired to learn that way. And I've seen myself, when I've visited these classrooms, that it often turns children off to learning. And at a very young age, they decide that school is a boring and punitive and uninteresting place to be.
So all of this is really important, Suzanne Bouffard. There's no question about it. Let's be honest. I mean, one of the facts that came out on this show yesterday is that many, many young children across the country don't have access to funded pre-K programs. So if a lot of these kids are at home, what are some of the basic things that mom and dad can do to at least get close to the experience, to replicate the kind of learning that you're saying is so important for these 3 and 4-year-olds?
The most important thing is for families to make learning a part of everyday life. That includes reading and asking questions about what you read, pointing out interesting things that you see in the world, whether you're pointing out the letter that starts your child's name when you see it on a sign outside, or whether you're counting how many stones you see on the path. Those kinds of things help children's brains develop, and they also get children in the habit of being curious and being learners. That being said, it's also important to try to expose your child to opportunities like children's museums and libraries and other kinds of public spaces. Many families don't have the resources to do those things. And that's one of the real concerns, that the families who don't have the resources to send their children to early education programs may also be lacking in the resources to do those kinds of things. Kids who are not in early education programs are home for a variety of reasons. Some families make that choice intentionally. And then there are some children who are home or with a grandparent or with a neighbor because that's really all that's available to them and possible. So across all these spaces, we need to make sure that children have opportunities to learn, whether it's in a classroom or a community center or a library or in conversation with the adult they spend time with.
Suzanne Bouffard, thank you for being here and for spending this time.
Thank you so much for covering this topic.
Suzanne Bouffard is a child development specialist, and she's author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten, and The Future of Our Children. Well, all this week, we've been covering the damage that Hurricane Harvey has inflicted on Houston. And as Harvey continues to devastate Americans in Texas and Louisiana, we've been asking you if your city is ready for an emergency like what we've been seeing along the Gulf.
Hi, I'm Peggy from Dunedin, Florida. Probably the Tampa Bay area is not ready, but the emergency management tries hard. We won't know until something happens, and our family plays it by ear.
Your thoughts on preparing for a disaster. Meanwhile, lots of you have been wondering how you can help your fellow Americans who are suffering in Texas and Louisiana. Now, aid agencies are asking for donations, and their key message here is that money is better than clothing or other goods. You can find a list of ways to get involved. You can visit our Facebook page or our website at thetakeaway.org, and there you'll find a helpful guide of some of the best agencies that are in need of your donations and your help right now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare. And by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.